morning. We welcome you all to our hearing room, but I have a special welcome on behalf of the court to Albany High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. And we also have students from Richland Center High School. Would they stand? Delighted to see you too. You may be seated. These students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from around the state, students in public schools, private schools, homeschool children, and ask them to come to hear an oral argument. If they accept our invitation, they are given materials about the case they'll hear, and they will, after the second oral argument, today it might be different, after that we will have a discussion by one of the justices assigned for the day. We'll discuss the case that you've heard, and we invite everybody to come to that discussion. The discussion will not be about the substantive issues in the case, but about the procedures the court uses to take a case, hear a case, and decide the case. So you're all welcome. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we'll give you, Marshall will give you a summary. Not seeing any hands raised, let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. On my right is a native of Richland Center, but not, you didn't go to Richland Center High School, did you?
Yes, I did, Chief. All 4 years.
You learn something every day here. At least I do. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He's the justice with whom you'll meet after this argument. I think you're going to meet right after this one.
Whatever.
What is best for them? Pardon me? After the second case. Fine. All right. Because we will have more students coming in after the second case. Okay. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. To Justice Crooks's right is Justice Patience Robinson. To Justice Prosser's right is Justice Annette Ziegler. And to Justice Patience Robinson's left is Justice Michael Gableman. That's the lineup for today, and we're going to now call 09AP3073CR, State versus Michael R. Greep. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Greep is Tricia J. Bushnell. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Michael C. Sanders. And Ms. Bushnell will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Bushnell.
May it please the court. Michael Greep was convicted following a bench trial where scientific evidence was presented not by the lab analyst who performed the test, but by a lab analyst who read the report. The United States Supreme Court in Boldcoming held that a lab analyst's statements in a forensic lab report are testimonial and require confrontation of a performing analyst. Thus, the real question here is whether this case is controlled by Boldcoming because analyst Diane Kalshower's statements about Greep's blood alcohol analysis content from her report were entered without putting her on the stand, or whether Patrick Harding's testimony constituted an independent opinion as presented in William versus Illinois. Here, Patrick Harding's testimony was not an independent opinion, but was entirely dependent upon the work of Diane Kalshower. In testifying about the results of the analysis, Harding offered no information other than the information and conclusions presented in Cashore's report. He performed no additional steps, he drew no additional conclusions, and thus he served simply as a conduit for the information that was inside of it. Indeed, upon cross-examination, he was unable to answer any of the questions that went into the work to create those conclusions, and the actual output from the machine that Cashore generated.
Ms. Bushnell, did the person who was testifying give his own opinion, or did he recite the opinion of someone else?
Well, Justice Crooks, he testified that it was an independent opinion. However, our understanding of what an independent opinion is has changed since then, since the decision of Williams versus Illinois, where we know that an independent opinion is where you do additional steps. Instead, he testified to the exact number that is in the report and the exact number that is in the underlying data. In fact, if you look at the actual report itself, if you go to Appendix B in Greep's brief in chief, you'll see that they provide on page 102, at the very top, they provide the specimen number in the laboratory report. That specimen number is 07FX017972, and it states final resort salts 0.152. Now, if you go to the underlying data that he was also presented with, you will see, there's two places where this appears. On page 105, that specimen number appears next to number 81, and it says simply results, 0.152. If you go actually to the chromatogram that he would have been looking at, which is again on page 115 of Appendix B, you see again at the top it says sample name 07FX17972, and if you scroll down to the bottom, it says simply amount 0.152 next to the compound ethanol.
Well, now, he was a section chief, was he not, of the lab?
He was, Your Honor.
And didn't he indicate what the normal procedures were in the lab?
He did, Your Honor, which is also exactly what the expert in Bullcoming testified to, that he was certified as an expert and that knew the information in that lab. However, exactly like they said in Bullcoming, that does not satisfy confrontation. Instead, that would go to a business record exception that he knew the standard procedures and how it was created. Here, the information that Greep was entitled to know was the work that Diane Cashower did, including the vial sampling and handling, what that her state of mind that day, how she personally calibrated that machine, how she used that machine, because all of that work is what made the output of the machine reliable. And without being able to question her about that, we have no ability to know if the output of this machine, which is simply 0.152, is reliable. And that is why it is no independent opinion. Instead, it is a mere reading of a report without simply introducing the report itself physically. In that regard, this case falls directly into Bullcoming. This is not the case of an independent analysis as we see in Williams versus Illinois, where additional steps are taken, the same in Deadwiller, for example. In those cases, some amount of analysis was performed by an outside lab. However, the testifying analyst performed an independent step, something extra that itself was not in that report. In those cases, DNA was conducted by an outside lab. The testifying analyst also performed additional DNA testing and testified through her analysis that there was a match between the two, whereas in either of those reports and either of those underlying data, that additional analysis didn't exist.
How can a subsequent witness, like we have here, not the one who actually administered the test and analyzed it, how can that subsequent witness reconstruct the test, the performance of the test, months or years later?
Yes, there are ways in which a lab could make that possible. One would be simply to videotape the analysis as it's happening, in which a reviewing analyst could see the steps that are being performed, can see all of these things, and testify that they are looking at this and they see that happening and they know that that took place, versus we don't know that any of these steps took place simply because of the output of the machine. Similarly, a question that is not presented here is what would happen if the individual who was part of the formal lab peer review testified. We don't know what Thomas Ecker saw. We don't know what Thomas Ecker did. He's the one who certified this as the peer reviewer in this case. But he may have that information through their formal lab processes. Again, that is not something that's presented here. And in addition, the idea that there are additional steps that need to be taken, that a lab might need to do something more, it was specifically discussed by the United States Supreme Court in Melendez-Diaz and rejected as a reason to find that the reports themselves weren't testimonial requiring confrontation. Instead, they said the confrontation clause requires this, and these are the steps that we can take, and that it is not overly burdensome. Additionally, it's not an independent analysis here, as we might see in other forensic sciences. For example, a blood spatter analysis, or an arson case, in which case those analysts would be given information that we could then give to an entirely new analyst who would make their own conclusion. In the blood spatter case, for example, you might present pictures or photos of the crime scene that you could give to another analyst who could create their own independent conclusion, not reliant on a report, whereas here none of that information was possible. And also in regards to additional ways that an analyst could later make the same conclusion, in Bullcoming, one of the things that they discussed specifically is that two samples were drawn and that there were two samples that were available. They introduced only the results from the first sample, but that the second sample itself could have been tested in that same regard.
I'm more familiar with the Intoxilizer 5000, the whole breath test procedure and the administrative rules that are attendant to that. And as I recall the law, that there is a certain presumption of accuracy oftentimes you find when you have the mechanical administration of a test. Yet, that presumption of accuracy doesn't attend when there are administrative rules that specifically set out what's necessary for admissibility vis-a-vis reliability. Again, certification of the intoxilizer. We've got certification pre and post here. Also, there's no presumption of accuracy because you need testimony regarding 20-minute observation in OWI cases. And they have to, in administering the test, observe the subject for 20 minutes to make sure there is no vomiting, no otherwise regurgitation, no added ingestion of alcohol. So that has to be done in order for the test to be considered reliable. What corollary is there in this testing procedure to the requirement of conditions precedent in order for there to be admissibility?
To make sure I'm understanding your question, Justice Bradley, what would they have to do specifically for a gas chromatograph to make sure that it's reliable?
You have the certifications. That's no problem. What else has to be done?
Well, beyond the certifications, you have to be able to ask about what allowed them to certify that and what those steps are. So when you talk, for example, about the breathalyzer and you talk about the observation, you're talking about someone who has personal knowledge as to what happened.
And that's in the administrative rules. Got to do it.
That's right. And here, for confrontation purposes, what we need is someone who can speak to at how the actual testimony here, what is actually being pointed to against Mr. Grebe and what he has a right to confront, is the work that creates those results from the machine. And that means you have to be able to speak to someone who knows that work. That would include vial handling and sampling. Harding testified he couldn't say whether or not there was a pop. He had no idea what the smell was. And the reason that that's important is there might be contamination of the sample, not for anyone's ill work, but it just may not be happening. In the same way, we also have to know what steps they took to calibrate the machine, when they calibrated it in relation to that, what those readings were, and what they personally know. We need to know their confidence level that day. We need to know whether or not they took some different step than they normally take. And we don't know that from any of the writings that are presented here.
Could I ask you a question? You referred to your appendix.
Yes.
104 and 105?
Yes, sir.
Could you explain what that is?
Yes, so this is the reading. So the bottle and the analysis number is basically they're looking at, here are the samples. The analysis number is the sample that they're loading into the machine. And here's the results that are coming out of the machine for every single one of those samples. So this is all of the samples that were run on that day, numbers 1 through 100, and then it repeats, and the sample that corresponded with that test, and the results of that test.
Do I understand that Diane Kalscher performed 124 different tests on August 30th, 2007?
That would be my understanding, Justice Preston.
Okay. And would it be your opinion? I assume these are all blood tests.
That is correct, Justice Preston.
Your position would be that none of the results of these 124 blood tests can be introduced unless Diane Kalscher goes to the court to testify?
Unless someone who has personal knowledge as to how they were created. Now, there are a couple of instances in this number that this being 124 tests, some of these are standards that you can see. But beyond that, what the United States Supreme Court noted in both Melendez-Diaz and Bull Cumming is the majority of cases, particularly these sorts of cases, settle. They don't go to trial. They're plea agreements. And so in that regard, it's not that Diane Kalscher is going to be going to court in 124 times for these. It's simply if they want to present this evidence in court, they have to be able to lay that verbal confrontation. And even if we were going to say that Patrick Harding had an independent opinion, even though we performed no independent steps and did no additional analysis, even if we were going to say that, that opinion would not be relevant unless what came in was true, unless we knew that the contents of the report itself were true. And in that case, we still have a foundation problem. We have no way for Harding to testify that he knows them to be true because he didn't perform any of those steps. And it again may be that a peer reviewer that in the formal process, Thomas Ecker here, may have that information. We don't know. That is not what was presented here. Instead, the person that they called had no, Patrick Harding, had no knowledge as to the steps that were taken, could not testify as to the sample, performed no additional steps like we see in Williams versus Illinois, and thus provided no independent opinion.
Well, he says it's an independent opinion. He looked at the material, and under the rules of evidence, an expert can look at material that's derived from or is part of another person's basic testing or opinion. And so Harding looks at this, looks at the new chart, just like a person looks at a photograph of the blood scene, right, which you say is acceptable. Well, he looks at this information about OWI, and he says, on the basis of my expertise, correct, whatever he says. So I don't see what differences it make between his looking at the test results and your other witness looking at the photograph and reaching their independent analysis. I think, and we can question the state, I think the state's position is it is an independent analysis because he looked at all the raw data, in quotes, himself, and he's giving his expert opinion.
The difference, Justice Abrahamson, is raw data is no different than the work Kalscher performed. That data that comes out of the machine is entirely reliant on the analysis and work that Kalscher herself is doing. And that's different than looking at a picture that nobody has done anything to. And so where we are different, and one other example, when we think about machine-generated data, an example, so two hypotheticals might be, for example, a fax machine. If you look at a fax machine and you see the fax comes out and there's that date and time on it, there was no human element in that. But if we use a printer, for example, in an affidavit where someone is typing into a computer and hits print and the affidavit comes out, the fact that the machine was used doesn't make the affidavit any less the testimony of the person who typed it up than it was originally. And that's precisely what happened here. In essence, Kalscher is performing the act of typing when she's giving reliability by stating and certifying as to the vial sampling, handling, calibration, all of those things. And then when the machine generates the report, there's no way to know any of those things about the reliability. And that's the difference between looking at a picture where we can simply say we know that this is a picture of the crime scene. No one's done anything different.
Except photographs don't always tell the truth. You can omit parts of the photograph by cropping it so that you don't get the full truth. You can, the photograph can be doctored just by the lighting techniques of how you take it, etc. So you can challenge the photo as being inaccurate. And you can challenge the photographer.
Well, the difference in a better test to think about this might be, would the underlying report itself be admissible? Because, for example, the photos of a crime scene would be admissible because they aren't testimonial. Whereas here in Bullcoming, right, they found the report itself testimonial and inadmissible when the essence of this report still comes through as conduit testimony from Harding. Whereas we look at Williams versus Illinois, where there is an independent analysis, that extra step, and there the court found, five justices found, that the underlying information and reports, if they had come in, would not themselves have been testimonial. And that is the difference here. Those photographs, that information upon which they're relying, would be able to be admissible because they're not testimonial. But here, that report is no different than the entirety of Kalshuer's work. That is the testimony. And that is the difference between a photo and...
In this case, the report was not admitted, right, as evidence.
Not physically admitted. However, the contents came in verbally, as we've seen both through the United States Supreme Court and this court, through what we would call conduit testimony.
And that makes it different than some of the U.S. Supreme Court cases where the report was admitted. Isn't that right?
We would say that it doesn't make a difference because, as I said, there is no difference between the conduit of simply regurgitating, simply reading the report in. If someone read the report in, that's no different than introducing it physically. And what Harding did here was no different than a reading of those numbers that are presented in that report.
Your position is, in effect, the report became evidence.
Absolutely.
And two, that there was no independent analysis here by the witness, and that what the witness was doing was really just reporting on these tests and had no personal knowledge.
Yes, Justice Abrahamson.
Where does you think that fits in the U.S. Supreme Court cases that I always have trouble keeping separate? Is it closer? Is it Crawford? Is it Davis? Is it Melendez-Diaz? Is it Bullcoming or is it Williams?
We believe it is Bullcoming because in Bullcoming, what was admitted was a report without the performing analyst who could do no additional analysis but simply testify as to the contents of that report. And that is what occurred here. Harding had no personal knowledge. He performed no independent steps. And the contents of that report were introduced verbally, though not itself physically. And if we think about it, we cannot allow, it would simply be allow the state to just do an end run around confrontation if we could just verbally read reports in without leave the actual physical thing out. There's no difference between what's in there and what's coming in through Harding's testimony.
Now, counsel, if this is a Bullcoming case, which is a 2011 case, how does it fit with our jurisprudence in State v. Williams, which is a 2002 case, and Barton, which is a 2005 case, and we have Deadwiller, which is a 2013 case, which is comparable, the court said, to Williams, which Williams was the one that had several different opinions with hard to find which one was the
That's right.
Unifying majority one, yeah.
That's right. Okay. It was a plurality opinion. So State v. Williams and State v. Barton would fit more into the idea of Williams versus Illinois and Deadwiller. And Barton is cited in Deadwiller. And that makes sense if you look at the holding itself without what their understanding of the facts is, because our understanding of the facts and what creates an independent opinion has changed since 2002. So in there, in Barton and Williams, we're saying an independent analysis is okay. If you perform an additional step, that's okay. But what they held to be independent analysis, we now know from Bullcoming, is not what actually took place in those cases. In some of those cases, which would be what they say is a peer review. But again, we don't believe that you need to even touch State v. Williams and Barton because there's no peer review in this case. If, however, the court finds that those cases are applicable, then they would have to be overturned to the extent that they contradict Bullcoming, which would be as the analysis of facts versus holding.
What would be the situation? This is a third offense, is it?
I believe it's a fourth, that's right.
A fourth?
I believe so.
What if it's a first offense?
I'm sorry?
What would be the case if it were a first offense?
I mean, the confrontation would still be required to any extent that it became a criminal matter. So if it's a civil issue, then that's something different. But if it's a criminal issue, you require confrontation.
Well, of course, in Wisconsin, its first offense is civil.
That's right.
Okay. On 104 and 105, do you know which ones of these are civil and which are criminal?
I do not, Justice Foster.
Does the analyst know which of these is Mr. Greeps?
I don't know.
I mean, is there anything to suggest that the analyst would know which of these tests is Mr. Greeps?
Well, I mean, the fact that the vial handling and sampling that comes in, which is also included there in the appendix, that does have Greeps' name on it, and that does specifically say Greep, and why the blood draw happened. All of those things would be in there. And certainly the analyst would know. Certainly that would just go more to why we would need confrontation, if anything. We don't know any of that information. We can't get any of that information from Patrick Harding. And that's to that extent, confrontation is even bolstered even more.
So do I understand that you would want either Diane Kalscher or Thomas Eckert to be a witness?
We definitely would want Diane Kalscher. I can't speak as to Thomas Eckert because there was no presentation anywhere in the record of what the formal peer review process would entail to know that, if he would have knowledge. There are certainly ways that labs that can satisfy this. As we've mentioned, in New Mexico, they draw double blood vials. Also, they could simply videotape what's going on for another individual to be able to watch that analysis. And certainly these cases, you know, are mostly resolved through plea agreements. So it would not be excessively burdensome on the state. But beyond that, the Supreme Court rejected that idea that it would be burdensome in Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming and required, in a case specifically like this, that confrontation take place.
Tell me how you got all these tests. How does the videotape work? How do you know when you're on number 18 versus number 21?
Well, Justice Foster, there's a number of ways that could happen. You could simply state out loud, "I'm on this sample," and then they would know that the analyst was working on that sample. Similarly, they could have an overview of the paperwork or the vial as it goes in, and you would know that that's the vial number going into the machine. There are a number of ways, but that isn't what happened here. What happened here is that the scientific evidence performed by Diane Kalscher and peer-reviewed by Thomas Ecker came in with someone who had no knowledge as to whether and how this took place, as to whether or not the sample was accurate. And that all of that goes to the reliability of this evidence, and that is what Mr. Greep is entitled to confront. In fact, we know from other cases that upon a robust cross-examination, some analysts have realized that they've made mistakes. Both we know that from an amicus brief filed in this case and from the reply brief, where we note specific instances related to a gas chromatogram. So the confrontation requires us to do this not because we guess something is wrong, but because we can't know something is wrong until there's confrontation. I see that my time is up.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Michael Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court. The State asked this Court to make two holdings. First, that the admission of the independent expert opinion testimony in this case did not violate the Confrontation Clause. And two, that the two Wisconsin cases that the Circuit Court and Court of Appeals relied on, State v. Williams and State v. Barton, have not been overruled by any opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court and remain good law. This might seem like a complicated case. In the briefs in support of GREEP, in the Court of Appeals, GREEP said that this case was controlled by Williams v. Illinois, and that Williams had overruled Barton and State v. Williams. In his brief to this Court, he said it's not controlled by Williams. Instead, it's controlled by Bullcoming, and that Bullcoming is distinguishable from Barton and Williams, and that those cases have not been overruled. And then in the brief of the State Public Defender in support of GREEP, that says that this isn't a Bullcoming case, it is a Barton case, but that somehow Barton and Williams have been overruled by Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming, even though it's not a Bullcoming case.
Did you say this wasn't complex, or did you just say it was complex?
No, it seems complicated because of all of these approaches, but it's actually not that complicated. What all of those approaches fail to take into account is the facts of the case. And there are three facts that I think really help determine what happened here and show that there is no confrontation clause problem. First, the lab report, which is in the record, it's two pages, in the record at AAP, or in the blue brief, at AAP 102 and 103, that was not introduced. The prosecutor wanted to introduce part of it. There was an objection, and the court didn't take it, didn't look at it, didn't consider it in any way, and made that very clear. So it was not introduced. Two, the expert who testified, Pat Harding, analyzed the machine-generated data that was produced by the testing, and he gave his expert opinion about his own he gave his own expert opinion about what those tests showed. And he did it in exactly the same way that the analyst would have, or that Ecker would have. He looked at all of the data, determined from the data that the machine had been calibrated properly, was working properly, and reached a conclusion, which he then gave in court. And third, he did not testify about what test result the lab analyst got. He never said, she said it came out at 0.152. He didn't say we reached the same answer. He didn't say she was right. He never brought it up because he reached his own opinion, which turns out to be the same, but that's because it's math. It's not because he relied on her opinion or her analysis. He looked at the data, did the math, and the answer is 0.152 based on that data. He didn't present any statement from the lab analyst. The only two statements in her report are on page 103, where she signed something saying two specimens were received, labeled, and sealed. And on page 102, where she says the result of the test was 0.152. He didn't testify to either of those things. There's just nothing there. She made two statements. They are not in the case. He didn't talk about them. There was nothing ever in this entire transcript where he said either she reached a 0.152 result or that she said that that when she got the samples, they were sealed and labeled. So as far as I can tell, there really is no confrontation issue because he didn't testify to that.
So what did he testify to exactly?
Well, he said that he was familiar with the lab procedures. That's on That's in the record at 3827. He said he reviewed the lab work that Kelker had done on sample 07FX17972, and that was a grief sample.
How does he review the lab work?
What's that?
How does he review the lab work?
He did the same thing that Ecker would have done and that the analyst did after she ran the test. He looked at all of the documents which are appended to the brief and analyzed the machine generated output, which is at 104 and 105, and all of the chromatograms, which are at 107 through 123. And because he's an expert and has been doing this for years and knows how this works, he was able to determine from that the machine worked properly, it was calibrated properly, and the result of this test was 0.152. Now, one thing that I want to make clear, he did say that he was looking at the work that she had done on sample 07FX17972 grief sample, but there was no objection to that. There was no objection to him being able to note that she had labeled that she had written that his sample was this one. So that's not a statement that was objected to. I don't expect it's a statement at all, but it was not objected to. So he could certainly look at that without any problem. He said that he looked at the same data that is available the day after the analysis for the person that reviewed the report when it came out, and that is the chromatograms and the paperwork associated with the whole analytical run that Diane did on the 30th of August 2007, which is what's appended to the brief. It's the same thing that the analyst looked at, that Ecker looked at when he signed off on it. It is a peer review. It's the same thing. He was asked if the blood sample was run through the instrumentation in a manner that comports with the rules and regulations of the lab. And he said, the procedures, all indications are that the procedures were followed, the instrument was operating properly calibrated. And that's because he could look at the data, and if you look at the data on page 104 and 105, it shows of the 124 vials which were put in, just one moment. There are 97 samples plus 27 others which are there to determine that the machine works and that this run is proper and that it's done right. And those are the ones, say number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 5, which say standard B, standard A, standard C, standard D, VLD227. Those aren't blood samples. Those are something else which they put in to determine if it's working properly. And then they can look at it and check the whole run, and if those standards come up the same or very close to the same, it tells the analyst or the reviewer that the run was done properly.
This is the question I don't understand in this case, among several others. He testified as to the machine was operating properly, calibrated before and after. Is he able to testify that the analyst worked the machine properly? That's what I don't quite, you know, how the blood sample was sent through and was it done properly? Is he able to testify to that? And is compliance with a procedure, not calibration, but how you do it, how you make it work, is that necessary for any kind of reliability or presumption of accuracy?
Well, he didn't testify to precisely what she did up until the time that she put the vial into the machine. As Greek points out, and it's true, in his testimony, he acknowledged that he had no personal knowledge of whether the blood was clotted, whether it had a foul smell, if there was a vacuum.
So
any of those things.
He's able to testify the machine works properly. Mm-hmm. He's not able to testify whether she worked properly when she dealt with the machine. Is that correct?
He could say that based on the output of the machine, you could find that it was done properly. He couldn't go to any of the earlier steps. He could say, here's how the lab works generally. Here's what we do every time.
So it was done properly. Sounds like, you know, errors were made. You know, I mean, it's kind of a little passive. Is he able to testify that she performed the test properly? Much like my analogy earlier, the officer in an atoxilizer has to observe for 20 minutes so there's no regurgitation or
other improprieties.
Is he able to testify in this case that she performed the test properly, not just that the machine was working properly?
I think that what he was getting at is that based on the output, you could tell that she performed the test properly, that she put the vial in, it went into the right slot, she put in the proper standards, the standard B, standard A, standard C, standard D, to check the machine, to make sure that everything was working. And then based on the results, and just to be clear, 104 and 105 are machine generated. She didn't write any of that. That all came out. So the actual number under 81 that says that his sample was 0.152, she didn't come up with that herself. That came out.
But the presumption of accuracy to a machine, the results of the machine, is premised on that the machine is being operated or the test is operated correctly.
And I think the best I can say is that he could tell based on the results of not only this sample, but all the samples and all the samples in the run and all the calibration and all the standards and everything that it was done properly. He said the calibration checks that are analyzed throughout the course of the analytical run read correctly, specifically and importantly. The two known samples that bracketed Mr. Grape's sample read within their accepted range. There was nothing unusual about the chromatograms, the output of the instrument related to this or any other samples in that run, so I guess the short answer is yes, it was run correctly.
Good.
That's what I have.
You indicated Mr. Harding relied on the materials on 107 through 123 of the appendix?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's say you were to lose this case, and any one of the 124 tests on pages 104 or 105 could not be introduced without the testimony of Diane Kelscher.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we have brilliant analysts, but they probably don't remember exactly what happened on all 124 tests every day.
I expect that there's no chance that she would know what happened in any test.
Okay.
Because, well, to be clear, I just want to make one point. This testing run of 124 vials is actually 97 tests.
97.
Because some of the others are actually standards, which they put in. So it's not 124 actual blood samples.
But
it's
only
27 other things that are put in to make sure that it's all working. But the actual number of blood samples which are being tested at a time is, in this case, 97. According to the lab, they do two runs per day, one at night, one in the morning. So in a given day, they may be doing as many as 200 tests. And the chance that the lab analyst is going to know anything about any of the tests, I think, is zero.
My question would be, if Diane Kelscher had to drive up to Winnebago County to testify in this case, wouldn't she have to rely on pages 107 through 123?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that when asked, what do you know about this test? She'd say, well, according to my notes, I ran the test, I didn't note anything strange happened, and here is what I came up with. And in this case, the expert looked at the same thing, didn't have anything more than that, and just said, well, I don't have any reason to think that anything strange happened. All of the results make sense, and the results show 0.152. I don't think there's really any real difference in what they would do, because she's not going to have any actual recall of any given test when she's running many hundreds a day.
Well, she wouldn't be running many hundreds a day if she was in Oshkosh.
So that takes care of the problem.
That's probably true. I guess at some point, if the answer is that it's okay, or that this would have been okay if Acker, who signed off on it, had been able to take the stand, then there's really not any difference, because what he did in his peer review is exactly what Pat Harding did when he did the same peer review. In State v. Williams, this court talked at some length about what a peer review is. And it's exactly what both of them did here. It said that they looked at the notes, made sure that the notes coincide with the evidence, that the data coincides with the conclusion, and just overall looking at all the data that has been collected in the case. It's meant to make sure that the conclusions in a report are right. And in that case, the expert testified that he would look at the data that the test yielded in the form of graphs and compare those graphs to standard graphs, and then from that conclude what had been tested. That wasn't a blood alcohol test, but it's the same idea. You look at the data, you look at everything, you see if it worked. And that's what Ecker did, and that's what Pat Harding did too.
Well, the
would have done. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. I didn't mean to interrupt you. The point of the Constitutional Confrontation Clause, as I understand it, is the defendant and counsel can question the witness so that the witness's testimony can be, by the questioning, either challenged and undercut, or that the witness will be able to substantiate the testimony, right?
Okay.
And that's the point of the confrontation. So the question to me, or the cutting edge for me, is can the defendant meaningfully question the witness on what the witness is testifying to? If he can't, the defendant can't, then I think it's a violation. If the defendant can meaningfully question the witness, then I think he's got what he's entitled to under the Confrontation Clause, namely right to challenge the witness's testimony. So what can the defendant here do? Now, the defendant did question the state's witness very carefully, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think that questioning showed as to the ability to get at the validity of the testimony?
Well, I think what you started with is that if the defendant has the opportunity to question the witness as to what the witness said, then it's fine. And in this case, the witness didn't use anything in the lab report, any statements. The only two statements that we have any place in this entire record from the lab analysts are that she got two specimens labeled and sealed, and after testing, she found a 0.152. He didn't testify to either of those two things. So if the confrontation issue is, could he cross-examine the witness as to what he said, he certainly can, because those statements didn't come in.
but he can't get at the validity of the data upon which the witness testified.
No, because that's what the expert found from the, that was the machine generated data. He can't get at it, exactly what the analyst did from the time that she got the sample until the time that she ran the test. What he could get at with the expert is what are the standard procedures, and based on the output, is there any reason to think that those procedures weren't followed? But that's pretty much the extent of it. But there isn't any case from the Supreme Court which has said that's not okay. This is not a Bullcoming case. I mean, it just isn't. In that case, the two main things are the lab report itself was introduced, and there was no expert testimony. Instead, there was someone who took the stand to authenticate it. But that's it. The court made quite clear there was no expert, and the actual report with statements was put in, and it said that violates the Confrontation Clause. But the court made clear that in a case where there was expert testimony or where the lab report didn't come in, it's not that case, and they haven't ruled on that yet. So at some point, they may, but at this point, there is no case. And so what we're left with is our state cases. And the defendant is not arguing that those cases should be overruled. Well, and there's no Supreme Court case which says that they have been. And under our state cases, I think it's extremely clear that there is no problem here whatsoever. This case is precisely like State v. Barton.
Okay. That's the 205 Wisconsin Court of Appeals case, right?
Which relied on Williams after Crawford.
On August 25th, 07, the date of the alleged offense, was the defendant entitled to have a second test at his request?
He refused chemical testing under the implied consent law. They took a test.
He could have asked for another test under
sure.
the law. Is it unusual to have two specimens?
My understanding from speaking to the director of the lab is no. They always take two.
And
well, not always, but they almost always take two. I don't want to.
Does the lab run a test on both specimens?
No. No, they run one. They keep the other. They often have to send those out in case there is a chance of drugs. There are all kinds of different tests which can be run. And so you have two of them, but you only run one.
Suppose the defendant had asked to test one of those specimens himself. What would have been the result?
Actually, there's a Court of Appeals case on that, which was my case, as it turns out. I believe under state law, you don't have any right to test that actual sample. If I recall correctly, I would have to go back and look. But I believe that's the case. It's a Weisinger is the name of the case. And I believe this court is going to appear that case. And I don't believe he would have the right to get the actual blood sample. He could certainly have his own taken, but I don't think he could get this one.
He refused the test here?
Yes.
They took it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
No warrant.
There's been no McNeely challenge in the case.
I didn't realize that he refused. I thought he went to the hospital. He did the preliminary breath test, and then he was...
He did. And then he
went to the hospital, and I thought that... I didn't think he said, no, you can't take...
No, he said no.
Okay.
And it's in the...
That's right, I
can find it, but he said no, that he wouldn't do it. They took him in, and they were going to take the test anyway. At that point, he said okay, but by that point, he had already refused. Well, he didn't. I take that back. He didn't fight it, but he had already refused.
Okay, so they asked to take the test. He said no, and
yes.
Then they said we are going to proceed, and then he said, well, okay.
Yes.
Oh. All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Was there any dispute that there was probable cause to take the test?
It hasn't been raised in the case, and to the best of my knowledge, no. He said he had had four beers. He was stopped because he was speeding. He said he had four beers. They had eyes, smell, slurring, and the PBT showed 0.114 is the number that's in my head. So I don't think there was any question that they could take the test.
If the defendant had challenged probable cause to take this test, would the PBT have been, could you have brought that in?
I don't believe so.
I mean, just to justify probable cause?
Oh, for that purpose, sure.
Okay, so they wouldn't want to challenge probable cause.
They wouldn't want to challenge it?
They wouldn't want to challenge probable cause for fear that the PBT might be brought
sure.
in.
Oh, sure. Yes. Sure.
It's your position, then, that the Confrontation Clause does not require the ability to get at what the analyst did. Is that your position? Because you said that Harding could not get at what the analyst did. He could get what are the standard procedures, and does it look like the procedures are followed? So I understood from that it's the state's position that the Confrontation Clause is not violated when you cannot get at what the analyst did.
If you can't get at what the analyst did pre-testing, I think that's true. In the state's brief, I cited U.S. v. Maxwell, a Seventh Circuit case from last year. And in that case, the court said that what happened, the expert testified about how the evidence in the crime lab is tested most times when determining whether it contains a controlled substance. That she had reviewed the data that was generated in that case, and she reached an independent conclusion. And the court found that that was fine, and that was enough under the Confrontation Clause. And the key was that she didn't read from the report. She didn't say, I reached the same result. She didn't do any of that. And that any problem with that, and to what the court said in Melendez-Diaz, and then has cited again in Bullcoming and in Williams, is that if there's any problem with what happened up until the time of testing, that goes to the chain of custody, the authenticity of the sample, and things like that, and that's up to the state. And if the state puts that in, it has to do it with a live witness. If it doesn't, there is no need for a live witness, but the finder of fact could, of course, find that the evidence is not reliable, that there isn't enough evidence, but those aren't issues that have anything to do with the Confrontation Clause. Those are other issues. And in this case, if the court had found, well, you didn't put in anything showing that when the blood samples got to the lab, they were sealed and labeled. You didn't say that there was a pop, or there wasn't a pop, I'm not sure which, that they weren't contaminated, that they didn't smell. And so I don't find that you have put in enough to convince me that the blood was his, that all of this was done right. The court could have found him not guilty. But in a bench trial, the court knew what the labs were. What the lab's procedures were, knew what happened up until the time the blood got there, knew what happened at the time it got into the machine, knew what the machine came up with, and found this fact that the expert witness gave his own independent opinion of the results and found him guilty. So if there's a problem here, I don't think it's a confrontation problem. I think it's a problem of chain of custody or sufficiency of evidence, but not the confrontation clause.
Well, do you think the chain of custody issue is part of the confrontation clause? Because that's what you can challenge, that it was not kept properly.
I can.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sanders. Can it be argued that the chain of custody issue is really part of confrontation? Because that's what you could challenge here.
Well, I don't think that's what the courts have found. In the site that I was getting at was in Melendez-Diaz at footnote 1. The majority opinion said, we do not hold that anyone whose testimony may be relevant in establishing the chain of custody, authenticity of the sample, or accuracy of the testing device must appear in person as part of the prosecution's case. So anyone who lays hands on the evidence is not going to have to testify. At this point, at least, we don't know what the court's going to do. But it said that it is the obligation of the prosecution to establish the chain of custody, but this doesn't mean that everyone has to testify. And any gap in the chain of custody normally goes to the weight of the evidence rather than its admissibility. It's up to the prosecution to decide what steps in the chain are so crucial as to require evidence, but what testimony there is must be live. In this case, there was no...
You quote Melendez-Diaz on page 31 of your brief, but the court there said gaps in the chain go to the weight rather than admissibility, yet the prosecution decides what steps they're going to put in, but as to the steps in the chain of custody, it has to be live testimony. So you may not have to prove A through Z in the chain, but you got to prove something in the chain. And when you prove something, it has to be live.
Yes, and if the state in this case had Harding say, according to the lab report, she got these specimens labeled and sealed, we would have a very different case, because that would likely be a testimonial statement that he would be putting in without her being there as a live witness. But that is not what happened. He did not testify to that. He didn't testify to any statement she made. So all of the actual testimony that came in was his testimony as a live witness. So if there is a gap, and in terms of the chain, what they had was the cop who, the phlebotomist and the officer. And then once it got to the lab, that it got a certain specimen number, and then what happened in the test and the test results. If there's any problem with what happened from the time it was mailed until the time it was put into the machine, that's a chain of custody question that hasn't been raised here. And even if it is, it's not a confrontation issue. My red light's been on for a while.
Thinking, Mr. Sanders.
So unless anyone has any further questions.
You want to sit down?
Sure.
May. Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Ms. Bushnell, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. To be clear, Mr. Greep is not requiring everyone who ever touched this sample to testify. What he's asking for is confrontation of the individual who performed the analysis. And what happens here, and Justice Bradley goes to the heart of this when we discuss, confrontation requires that he be able to discuss and confront meaningfully the individual who performed the test. Implicit in the statements and the results that come out from the machine is that Diane Kalshauer received those vials, that they were sealed, and that they were not contaminated. She certifies to that, and that is what is implicit in those results. Those results are meaningless if those are not true. And in fact, we can think about it in a hypothetical. What if she dropped it? What if she dropped this in the middle of somewhere, it broke, or the seal moved off? We cannot know from those printouts any of that information about that contamination unless we have the ability to confront someone who had knowledge of that. And in fact, when we look at Bull Cumming states...
When I read the cross-examination of the expert witness, I thought the lawyer did an excellent job. He knew what he was talking about. He knew the subject matter. He knew the soft points of the evidence the state was presenting. So the court was free to not accept as sufficient evidence the testimony of the expert, right?
Yes, Justice Rogenczak, but what we also know now in subsequent case law, because Bull Cumming came after Mr. Grief's trial, and that's what's important when we understand and we look at these case law, the arguments that have shifted because the case law has shifted pending this case. So, for example, when Mr. Grief was arguing that Williams applied, it was because nobody knew if Williams applied. This court made clear in Dead Willer that it doesn't apply, and so now we know Bull Cumming is still good law. Bull Cumming, which came after Mr. Grief's trial, says that somebody needs to be able to answer all of those questions. It's not just enough to probe if it's not meaningful. And Harding had no an ability to answer about that. And similarly, going to Justice Prosser's question about is it meaningful if they don't remember, the United States Supreme Court has said very clearly in Melendez-Diaz that it is. In Melendez-Diaz, the court goes through to say it's entirely true that a lot of analysts don't remember things. But they do remember when they mess up. Those are the things that they remember. And unless you bring them to the stand, it's okay for them to say they don't remember, but it has to be before the jury or the judge in this case to make that decision as to that reliability. You have a right to confront them, even if we don't know what confrontation will bring. And that is the crux of why confrontation exists. We don't know what it will bring until we get there. Similarly...
Let me ask this. Suppose I'm the analyst. I've got two vials here, and I drop one of the vials, which was your hypothetical. If I had any integrity at all, wouldn't I say, I better test the other vial?
Well, and that's exactly the point of confrontation. We can't just presume, one, that everyone has integrity. We know that from the number of lab scandals that have existed across the country. Is cited in Bull Cumming, they talk about a lab that had over 295 blood samples in this case that came out incorrect. Yes, and that's why confrontation is required. We want to know if that individual has integrity. That's why we need to put them on the stand. Instead, what happens here is Harding is permitted to vouch for her. Harding is allowed to say, hey, everything Kalshura did must have been great without any knowledge as to that. We don't know. Maybe she had an accident that day. Maybe that day was a very hard for her. We just don't know. And that's what he is entitled to confront. Similarly, to your point about could he have requested a second test, that actually was also an issue in Bull Cumming. There were two samples, and the defendant did not request a testing of that second sample. And in there, the United States Supreme Court said, confrontation is the burden of the state. He is entitled to confront the accuser that the state is putting on. It is not satisfied that he could have requested it himself. And so even though the second sample in Bull Cumming wasn't tested, they still found confrontation required. But certainly the state itself could have had a new analyst test it and satisfied that if they were worried about someone who couldn't appear. Finally, the state talks a lot about the fact that Harding did the same thing as a peer review. Well, we just don't know that. There's nothing in the record that reflects that. And also beyond that, it's not an issue in front of this case. What we have is the contents of the report, which implicit in that report are the testimonial statements of what she did that day, what she did when she put it into that machine, and that comes in without any confrontation of the analyst who did it. Because for all those reasons, we ask this court to find that Mr. Grief's right to confrontation was violated.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Bushnell. Thank you, Mr. Sanders, for your arguments on the confrontation clause. And as you both know, we've had several cases on this, including one that I don't think was mentioned, which is Flora. Is that the name of that? And Crawford has caused difficulties across the country on confrontation. That concludes our hearing. in 2009 AT 3073 CR, State versus Michael R. Greek. The court will take a few moments in recess and then call the second case. The students who wish to leave may do so. There will be new students coming in. We are in recess.